Radio Prague News. The Czech Republic will try to secure its participation in future Eurozone summits. An agreement was signed in Prague on Friday, sealing the transfer of the Galileo Supervisory Authority to the Czech capital. And the Czech Foreign Ministry has dismissed criticism from the European Commission that it is making excessive demands on foreign applicants requesting a residence permit in the country. The Czech Republic will try to secure its participation in future Eurozone summits. Czech Foreign Minister Karel Schwarzenberg said on Friday it would be good for the country to be involved and for its voice to be heard, even if it was not yet a Eurozone member. The centre-right Czech government this week approved a 38 billion crown loan to the IMF and gave conditional approval for the Czech Republic to join the emerging fiscal compact, a process that would either have to be ratified by Parliament or in a national referendum. GCA head Carlos de Dorides and Czech Transport Minister Pavel Dobeš on Friday signed an agreement on moving the headquarters of the Galileo Supervisory Authority to Prague. The European Union's planned Galileo satellite navigation system is meant to give the EU its own worldwide navigation system, similar to the US GPS and Russia's GLONASS. Galileo is due to begin basic operations in 2014 and ultimately to offer 32 satellites covering the globe. The Czechs lobbied hard for the opportunity to host the headquarters of the new navigation system, and Czech firms are expected to benefit, for instance, by taking part in the development of signal receivers or applications for Galileo. The transfer of GSA staff to Prague is expected to begin in May. The Czech Foreign Ministry has dismissed criticism from the European Commission that the country's approach to foreign applicants requesting a residence permit violates the EU's directive regarding the free movement of people. Among others, the European Commission has expressed objections to the policy of asking residence permit applicants to prove that they have secured accommodation in the country. The EC says this is not in harmony with the free movement directive that all EU states were supposed to transpose in their legislation by April of 2006, and has threatened to file action against the Czech Republic over its alleged failure to observe the said directive. The Czech Republic has 2 months to react to the criticism. If Brussels finds Prague's response insufficient, it may hand the issue over to the European Court of Justice, which may impose sanctions on the country. Hackers attacked the website of the Czech government as well as the online presence of OSA, a Czech copyrights holders association, on Thursday night. Both websites were up and running again by Friday morning. Behind the attack are hackers associated with the activist group Anonymous, which has been targeting websites of such organizations as the FBI, the White House, and various record labels and copyright holders in a reaction to a recent blocking of the online content sharing service MegaUpload.com. The loosely organized group Anonymous has been linked to attacks around the world aimed at punishing governments for policies they disagree with. The attacks on the Czech websites are believed to be connected to the Czech Republic signing the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement in Tokyo on Thursday. And finally, a quick look at the weather forecast. The coming weekend is expected to bring partly cloudy to overcast skies with more snow and day temperatures dropping to -3 degrees. Nighttime lows can reach -15, though in some places as much as 10 degrees lower. I'm Daniela Lazarová, and that's the end of the news.
Hello and welcome. You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Radio. My name is Sarah Borůvka. Coming up in today's program, a landmark ruling on home births may bring a breakthrough in the ongoing debate about giving birth at home in this country. And we have all the latest business news. Then, later on in this week's edition, we learn about a rare and fascinating book about the life and times of architect Adolf Loos. All that and more coming up, so do stay with us. A ruling on Thursday by a Prague court might lead to a breakthrough in the ongoing Czech debate about home births. While state officials and healthcare providers have consistently opposed the practice over safety concerns, the court decided that mothers indeed have the right to choose the place of their child's delivery, and the state has to provide all necessary assistance. Jan Richter has the details.
What has been described as a breakthrough ruling was delivered in the case of a Prague woman who sued one of the country's largest hospitals for refusing to provide a midwife for the home birth of her third child. The court rejected the woman's plea because it was filed too late. The verdict was in fact issued on the day the child was born. However, referring to a recent ruling of the European Court of Human Rights in a similar case in Hungary, the judge said women indeed have the right to choose the place where they give birth to their children. The court also said that the woman was entitled to all necessary assistance from the hospital because the state had so far denied the registration of private midwives who would otherwise do the job. Lawyer Zuzana Candiliota represents the woman in this particular case, as well as dozens of other Czech women in similar situations. She believes the court's ruling could force the authorities to change their negative approach to home births.
In the justification of its decision, the court expressed some far-reaching conclusions that might be adopted by other courts too. In practice, this means that women who wish to give birth at home can approach their hospital demanding a midwife to assist in the birth.
The ruling has received little applause from the Czech medical community. The head of the Czech Gynecological and Obstetrical Society, Vladimír Dvořák, called the verdict an empty gesture.
Our attitude has not changed at all. Our utmost concern is to ensure maximum safety for the mother and the newborn, and we still maintain that home births are non-legi artis. This means that doctors planning to deliver the baby in the mother's home would not be following the latest medical standards.
Hospitals argue that they do not have enough staff that could assist at home birth or the means to train them, a view upheld by a leading Czech expert in medical law, Ondřej Dostal. He believes the government should allow independent midwives to render their services to mothers who want to deliver their babies at home.
I think it should act on this in the sense that it would enable registrations of home birth assistants. And I think it is also necessary from international law point of view, because recently there has been a judgment against Hungary that Hungary is wrong in prohibiting the providers to give home births. And I think every country like this should rectify their practice.
Meanwhile, it seems that the Czech Health Ministry will at long last answer the calls to sanction home births. On Thursday, ministry officials announced a working group would be formed to prepare new legislation, which will determine conditions under which Czech women will be allowed to give birth at home.
Thank you for this story, Jan, and of course, we'll be keeping an eye on how this issue develops. Now I'm joined in the studio here by Christian Falvey for this week's business news.
The Czech Republic received almost 31 billion crowns more from the European Union's budget than it contributed in 2011, the finance ministry has reported. The difference was roughly 17 billion lower than in 2010 due to a revision of national accounts and a suspension of payments caused by problems with some operational programs. Finance Minister Miroslav Kalousek said that despite those problems, the Czech Republic remains a significant net recipient of money from the EU, having secured a total 176 billion between 2004 and 2011. The biggest part of EU subsidies came from the Cohesion Fund and Structural Funds, from which the Czech state received 43.5 billion last year. Revenues from the Common Agricultural Policy reached 26.5 billion in 2011.
On the other hand, the Czech Republic is in danger of having to return 15.6 billion to the EU due to errors in the use of European subsidies for transport projects, according to results of a European Accounting Court control. Previously, the government has estimated that no more than 11 billion would have to be returned. The project in question is an unfinished part of the D8 motorway leading from Prague to the German border. The Accounting Court cites dubious tenders, non-transparent increases of excess work hours, and delays in the completion of the subsidized projects. The Accounting Court also labeled the repair of a railway bridge in Kolín for 1.2 billion as problematic. The Transport Ministry wants to shift the subsidies from problematic to problem-free projects. However, the Czech Republic has to spend the money by 2015.
Prices at Czech filling stations have continued to reach new record levels over the past week. The top-selling Natural 95 rose by 60 hellers on average to 36.25 crowns a litre, while the price of diesel went up by 69 hellers to 36.91 per litre, according to data from the company CCS. The increases have been caused by a poor crown-to-dollar rate and high oil prices, which may increase even more depending on the EU's decision on an oil embargo against Iran. The Association of Petrol Stations has proposed a cut in excise duties on diesel oil. However, this was opposed by Finance Minister Miroslav Kalousek, who believes it would be counterproductive and run against international agreements.
Despite the age of internet banking, banks in the Czech Republic plan to open tens of new branches this year, according to a poll carried out by the Czech press agency. The largest expansion is being planned by UniCredit Bank, which wants to add over 50 branches to the 23 it opened last year. Česká spořitelna, the largest bank in terms of client numbers, wants to open 14 new outlets, and Poštovní spořitelna, which belongs to the ČSOB group, wants to open 13. In contrast, Komerční banka and Raiffeisen Bank, among others, said they had completed the main expansion of their branch networks last year, when Raiffeisen Bank, for one, saw its largest ever expansion. By the end of 2011, there were more than 2,000 bank branches in the Czech Republic.
The opposition Social Democratic Party proposed six bills this week aimed at decreasing the indebtedness of Czech households. The series of bills looks to limit contractual fines, introduce an obligation to ask a debtor to pay before filing a lawsuit, and integrate multiple orders for property seizures. The party says that Czech households owe more than 1 billion crowns and often end up in debt traps, one of the reasons for which they believe are the harsh conditions of debt collection. The government says it is willing to discuss the legislation and is already considering some of the measures on its own. The STEM agency reported this week that exactly one-third of Czech households currently find themselves in difficult financial situations, which is in fact an improvement year-on-year. Slightly less than one-half of respondents said they felt they were well off financially.
And that was all the latest business news brought to you this week by Christian Falvey. Thank you for that, Christian. And now the time has come for our feature. This week's edition of The Arts has been prepared for you by Jan Wellinger.
In today's Arts, I talked to artist and editor Carrie Patterson about the first English language edition of a rare and fascinating book that was first published in 1936. It was written by the third wife of modernist architect Adolf Loos, and she was Claire Beck Loos, or Klára Beková Loosová of Plzeň. Until recently only available in German, the new edition is called Adolf Loos, A Private Portrait, and is published by Doppelhaus Press. Loos died in 1933, and Beck, who was Jewish, died tragically in the Holocaust after being deported to Terezín. Now, the book is a rare glimpse of Mr. Loos at the height and fall of his career, also of their unusual marriage. She was 34 years his junior, and its revealing of Claire Beck herself as an inspiring artist. For Carrie Patterson, this was also an intensely personal project. She is Claire Beck's grandniece. Now, when we spoke on a line to her home in California this week, the first thing Carrie Patterson discussed was the history of the book.
It was published first in 1936 in Vienna, and then it has seen two reprints there in 1985 and then recently in 2007.
Is it fair to say that in the German language, at least until fairly recently, it was part of the canon on literature about Loos as an architect?
I think, actually, it's interesting that you ask that question. It was not in the canon because it was an obscure book by a Jewish author. A lot of the books disappeared. At this point in our research about Claire's past and her tragic death, we understand that she tried to send a number of books out of Prague in 1941, but they never made it to the United States. So I believe a lot of her books were actually destroyed. What this means is that the book, while it had been collected in a certain amount amongst the Viennese and probably in the Czech Republic as well, very few of those copies can be found today.
When you got involved in this project, it was really like unraveling a thread to a degree. You must have been sorting through a lot of older material, researching in archives, that sort of thing.
Yes, our family had a number of things in our archive, and we have been in a bit of a treasure hunt, actually, over the last, I would say, 5 years, looking into her letters, into photographs that we now understand were taken by her, as Claire was a professional photographer, and trying to understand what happened in 1938 to 1941 when she was deported to Terezin at the end of 1941. So we have letters of hers, and we've learned a lot along the way having those translated, but we had a number of those things that just kind of laid quiet in our archives for typical emotional, personal reasons. They had not been looked into much by my father. So we did do a lot of research, and from that, this extraordinary book emerged, and I am so very happy to have been able to meet Claire in this way and to know her. She was an extraordinary person and a wonderful artist and wonderful writer.
If we start at the beginning, how did Claire actually meet Adolf Loos?
Claire met Adolf Loos when she was a young woman in her own apartment, which was designed by Adolf Loos in 1909. She was the daughter of industrialists, and her father, Otto Beck, was quite known in Pilsen. He was part of the Beck and Hirsch steel and wire manufacturing. And Otto had learned about Loos early in his life as a businessman and was enamored of his architecture. And as soon as he could, he contracted Loos to do the interior remodel of his apartment. So with the Becks being clients, Loos was over at the house a lot, and that was when he first met Claire. But they re-met each other sometime when she was in her 20s, what is believed to be when she was in Paris doing some artistic experimentation, I guess you could say, with a sort of bohemian art circle there. At least that's according to research that's done by Adolf Opel, the editor of the 1985 edition. So they re-met each other there, and one might imagine that Loos was cavorting around with his other clients like Tristan Zara and may have run into her. And he also went to a performance of Josephine Baker with the Beck family, and I think that was the beginning of their courtship.
Was this a likely courtship or a likely marriage, given, for example, the different backgrounds of say, Loos and Claire, and also the age difference?
Well, I think the age difference is the most significant thing. They were 34 years apart, but their characters seem to be part of a pattern, I think, that's known in history, where you have an older man who becomes a kind of mentor to a young artist, male or female. And in this case, it seemed very much that Claire was willing to go through what she did with him. He was not an easy man to live with. But she did that in part because of what he offered her about the world. And she was totally struck by his genius, by his way of seeing things, and I think learned quite a lot in those couple short years that they were married. So in that sense, I think it's unlikely and likely at the same time.
Certainly, you get a sense of the awe with which she saw him at the beginning through some of the vignettes. What was her own relationship with his architecture, either the interior designs or buildings themselves?
Well, I think when a person grows up in a certain kind of architecture, and I can attest to this having grown up in a house designed by an architect, my father is an architect who studied with Frank Lloyd Wright, that one absorbs the kind of aesthetic and the spatial awareness of being in that environment and forms happy memories there. And the childhood memories of space can be then seen in other works. So there's a natural affinity and a kind of feeling at home in other spaces that are similar to that. So I think in that sense, she did know him way before they actually started courting.
Open space was something that was, I guess, a very central concept to his work, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, the Beck apartment is like many of the apartments that he did in Pilsen for what were, on the whole, wealthy Jewish industrialists in that city. In those apartments, you can stand at one end and look all the way through to the other side so that the spaces and the areas of living kind of fold into one another, and there's a sense of continuity in the space. Not only is it very modern, but Loos opened up spaces that didn't exist before in the apartments. And I just learned this through a lecture that was given by Dr. Irena Murray, the director of the British Architectural Library at the Royal Institute of British Architects in London. Loos would go into these apartments and open up interstitial spaces. In between one room and another, there might have been a dead space that just got closed in by the framing and was never used in the apartment. And by Loos taking out these interior walls, he found areas that weren't used and really didn't exist before.
One of the vignettes in the book that also dwells strongly on the sense of space and kind of central or key parts of the apartment, of course, is the one that is highlighted right on the jacket, the shimmering fish. Could we talk a little bit about that?
That's a great story to talk about because it does take place in the Villa Müller, which everybody in your audience is probably familiar with in Prague. He goes into the house when it is not finished at all. It exists in the framing pretty much only. And he has already at that point a complete vision of what the space will be like and how people will live there. And as he describes that out loud to people, his workmen and the client himself, they're all there and they cannot make that jump with him. So Loos loses himself in this description. And what Claire is able to record is something very essential that we know about Loos now. He pre-visioned these spaces. He didn't develop them sitting at a drafting table. He had them entirely in his mind as one unit, and then drew them often on backs of envelopes and napkins in coffee houses, and then worked out the engineering details with professionals in that arena. So that episode specifically, Loos walks into the house, and he can see fish tanks, and he can see where František Müller will come in at the end of a long, hard day and sit by the fireplace and relax and be surrounded by these shimmering fish and create a sense of otherworldly existence.
Let's discuss the book itself. It's not only fascinating in terms of the contents, of course, but also the form.
Yes, Claire chose to write her book as a personal narrative of her life with Loos. And she, although she does arrange it somewhat chronologically, what she's able to do is create a series of really what are snapshots of his life toward the end of his most productive period into his grave illness toward the end of his life. And she's able to track his personality, his architectural intentions, his environment, his milieu, the people that supported him, his critiques. All of these things are woven together. And she does this just so beautifully and simply, in clear, imagistic language. You can see that she's using her photographer's eye every time she looks at him in one of these texts.
That's nicely said, and sort of leads into a question that I had about how revealing is the book of her as a person and as an artist.
I'm not sure how much of this was intentional, but I think the book is clearly also an autobiography of this time. I mean, it had to have been somewhat intentional because she includes her own reactions to certain things that were happening around her. And one of the things that struck me was how awkward initially she felt in certain circumstances that Loth himself felt absolutely at home, and how much he kind of walked into the world open and willing to face whatever was there. And for her, as a younger woman, she could really sense the barriers that were there for her and things that were internal limitations but also external. She functioned as his secretary and his emissary in several situations, a lot of times because he was too ill to go places and meet people. But she found herself in situations meeting people, dignitaries and artists alike, that she never would have had access to. And so she really had to rise to those occasions. And you see her throughout the book developing into a very confident person who is a very good representative for Loth and all of what he stands for. So I think in that sense, it's a very interesting portrayal of what happens to a young woman through the course of this kind of mentorship, erotic connection to an older man.
A lot of these episodes are quite humorous as well, aren't they?
Yes, I think they are. They're filled with a sense of Loth's character as he approaches people. One of my favorite stories is when Claire goes to meet Matisse in the south of France, and she is there specifically to get him to sign a petition to start a Lothian school of architecture. And she enters into Matisse's space. The story is rather short, but it describes the environment that Matisse lived in just a wonderful way, with the clear white spaces, the open spaces, and the sense of the light in Matisse's studio. And Matisse turns her down. But what you get a sense of is how that relationship between Loth and the famous people of his environment had to be channeled through her, and maybe what that risked for him, but how willing he was to do that.
If we look at their marriage, it was a very brief one. On what terms did the marriage end?
Well, it's not entirely clear in the book, but we have a sense that there was a big fight, that Loth was almost out of his mind with jealousy and rage at one of his former students, who turns out to be Kriegerbeck, taking on one of his clients as his own. And he cannot bear this thought that he would be outdone by someone that he taught. He flies into a rage, and Claire bears some of this and is accused of betraying him, and she walks out and she leaves him. And she's very hurt by this, and the result of it is Loth is devastated, and so is she. And when she tries to go back and repair it, because she really did love him very much, he won't take her back. He's of that mind that once he's been shamed in that sense, that he would never go through that again. So up until the end of his life, however, she retained some kind of extraordinary affection for him, and even saw him very close to the time where he died. And it seems very clear in the book that it was mutual, this kind of eternal love.
Artist and editor Carrie Patterson was talking to Radio Prague's Jan Wellinger in this week's edition of The Arts. Thank you very much for that, Jan. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's program, but please tell us if you've got any thoughts on what you've heard on the show today. The postal address here is Vinohradská 12, 12099, Prague 2. And of course, the address for emails is english@radio.cz. And of course, as always, everything you've heard in the program can also be found at our website, radio.cz. There you will also find a huge archive of reports and features in both text and audio form. And you can sign up for free news email and use our podcasting. Please also look into adding us on Facebook or following us on Twitter. We'll talk to you again soon, but until then, from me, Sarah Borufka, and from all of us here at Radio Prague, thank you very much for listening, and take good care.